Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast. Whether you're nearing retirement, entering the workforce for the first time, or caught somewhere in the confusing muddle in the middle, you're likely sensing it and you're probably living it. We know we are, and we want to know why. Listen in as we interview experts and everyday people like you to find out how best to navigate the ever-growing weirdness of work in the modern age.
Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast, season three, may I say? Woo-woo! And here is our opening guest, Tony Moroney. Now, full disclosure, Tony and I work together at my in-house role over at Macro, who are a global FM provider. So welcome, Tony.
Thank you, Dan. And thank you, Alice, for having me. I'm happy to be here with you both.
We're really, really thrilled to have you here. And it is Pride Month. We are just closing out of Pride Month. And Tony and I are working on a big internal comms piece together around this topic. And I thought it was an absolute no-brainer to bring him onto the podcast to really talk about how to make allyship at work real, not performative, during Pride and beyond. So thought it really seizes opportunity whilst we're campaigning about it so much internally. So do you want to give us a bit of a brief overview about you and your career journey and history?
Happy to do. Thanks, Dan. So I have a bit of an eclectic background, and I like to share because I think it really highlights how diversified skill sets can actually also tie into DEI strategy and how we approach people in bringing their true and authentic selves to work. I am a recovering lawyer who I'm licensed in New York and New Jersey. I'm licensed before the United States Supreme Court, and I used to work as a criminal prosecutor, then worked in anti-money laundering and became the counterterrorism investigator, worked as chief of staff to general counsel, and then was tapped on the shoulder to give corporate real estate a go and haven't looked back since. So I've been working in facilities, corporate real estate, including asset management and brokerage for the last 5+ years, and joined Macro as of April to take on a role as the operations director for the Americas within a global facilities company. On the side of my desk for the last 25 years, I've been a very big DEI advocate. So starting in high school, I was an LGBTQ peer educator and counselor. As one of the only openly queer persons in my high school, I was a resource for others who needed somewhere to go. From there, I went on to, in university, being a peer educator and advocate as well for LGBTQ plus inclusion. And then from there, kind of went into working as a prosecutor, working with victims of crime, specifically focused on how do we support different communities and their needs, all the way through my corporate journey, where I was the global co-chair of the Pride Employee Resource Group for the last 7 years before I left the firm. And it's a big passion area for me. I jokingly say I have 4 older sisters and a younger brother. I realized that I was a feminist before I realized I was gay. And I think there's so many aspects of gender inclusion, gender equity, and focusing on LGBTQ plus rights that dovetail. So I'm a huge proponent, both personally and professionally, of supporting folks in that space.
I'm curious, just as you were talking, I was thinking about this context that we find ourselves in this year in Pride Month, right? So it's slightly different context from last year. There's maybe a little bit more discussion around DEI, a little bit more backlash that we haven't had previously. And I'm just curious to get your sense of what is the wider context? What are you seeing now? And what does this particular Pride mean to you and to the broader community?
Yeah, it's a great question, Alice. And I think, you know, addressing the bit of it up front, I think we've seen a big policy shift across this administration. And it's not just in the US, we're seeing a big shift globally. I think there are some important conversations that need to be had about what inclusion, belonging, diversity, equity, inclusion type programming needs to be. But I think at its core, none of the mission changes. So to me personally, this Pride Month is remembering that Pride started as a march. It wasn't a parade. It wasn't, you know, corporate sponsorship and banners. It was a group of people who came together after being completely irate and marginalized and saying, enough is enough. We are not going to wait for somebody to recognize us. We're going to demand access to rights that we should have had under the equal treatment of the law. And I think it's a reminder this year in particular that it started as a rally. It started as a march, and we can't take the hard-fought rights that we've achieved for granted. And we all need to stand beside, in the US, in the global community, we need to stand beside one another. In particular for me, and I'm trying not to get emotional, but the attacks on the trans community have been particularly difficult and particularly pointed. We're seeing service members of the United States military being forced out because of their identity as transgendered or non-binary. We're seeing political attacks. We're seeing human attacks. People have physically been assaulted and violently attacked on the streets. And it's particularly hard and troublesome because at the end of the day, we're all human beings, right? Watching violence against another human being is never something we want to see. But when it's particularly driven towards a marginalized and, you know, historically marginalized community, it becomes extremely poignant. And we've seen a significant increase in things like suicide attempt. And, you know, it's my reminder to everyone is we're talking about people. At the end of the day, how one, you know, identifies or how one expresses their gender should be irrelevant. They're a human being. They bleed the same way you do. Treat everyone with equal dignity and respect. And whether one's religious or not, there's a core tenet of just treat people with kindness, treat people with love. And for me, that is what this pride in this year is all about.
Great. So what does real allyship at work look like to you, like in action?
So oftentimes we find, and, you know, Dan intro'd this as performative allyship. I think a lot of folks are willing to sign up and put their name on a mailing list or to turn up every now and then to an internal event. They're willing maybe to wear a rainbow lanyard or to have a placard on their desk. But to me, you know, that's base level. That's very much just acknowledging that there's a problem or that there's a community that's been disadvantaged in the past and that you're at least seeing that. True allyship is really being willing to learn and the curiosity. I can raise my hand as somebody who's been, you know, an ally across the LGBTQ plus spectrum for the last 25 plus years. And obviously long before that, as soon as I came out and realized that I was gay myself, I don't have the lingo down. I don't know every letter of the acronym and would I expect an ally to. I think there are folks within the community who may, and my reminder that I always like to tell them is, I would rather meet somebody who comes to the table with an open mind and an open heart that's ready to be a supporter and champion. I would rather meet them and help them on that journey than to alienate them. And I think real allyship is those folks that show up, that want to learn. They may not have it all down. They may not know the lingo, but in their heart, in their mind, they're committed to supporting other people as people and driving some sort of, you know, net support. Allyship, especially in the corporate workspace, is creating a space for visibility. Being queer, being LGBTQ plus, particularly if we look at their transgender and non-binary colleagues, it's creating a safe space for them to express their gender identity and not have to be hidden in a closet or to be overly performative about what gender they need to represent. It's creating a space at the table, especially at the executive level. We still don't have adequate representation. If you look at most statistical estimates of what percentage of the population identifies as LGBTQ+, the numbers at the corporate board level and at the executive level are paltry compared to what social estimates look like, which means there's still a lot of good work to do. And it's when folks recognize that there isn't a person at the table representing that group, being a voice for them and supporting and championing what they would need or expect in that kind of environment.
There's a lot of acronyms and so much to learn, and we want people to have that open mind. Can we just define what some of the acronyms actually mean for the people who are thinking, oh yeah, do you know what? I hear the term, but I don't know what that is. Let's start there. And then I'd really love to understand what does that look like and start to manifest like in a corporate work environment.
Absolutely. So I guess to kind of start at the beginning, I think there's a lot of misunderstandings around some of the base level terminology. There's a really great tool called the Gender Bred Person, and it tries to break these down. So your sexual orientation is who you're attracted to. That is driven also by your own gender identity. Your gender identity is how you internally view your gender. So it's not derived by biological sex. Biological sex is, frankly, the genitalia with which you were born, and then a doctor's determination, because there are people who are born with both or neither in terms of the, you know, the reproductive organs. So gender identity is how you feel about your own gender. Gender expression is how you outwardly convey that gender. Sexual orientation is based off of your gender identity, who you're attracted to. So a person who identifies as male that is attracted to another male, or a person that identifies as male, would be considered gay. Whereas a, you know, a person who identifies as male who's attracted to someone who identifies as a female would be heterosexual. Looking at the acronym itself, the acronyms can go on and on and on. As last I checked, I think it was at 37 different letters in the LGBTQIA+. You know, the Q is one that we get a lot of questions about. It can mean queer. It can mean questioning. Is queer an okay thing to say? I think in many ways, the community has tried to reclaim it as a word to say it does mean different in a way that is ill-defined, and we're okay claiming that as a term for ourselves. But obviously, there's a way in which somebody can call you queer that is naturally derisive and offensive. And so it's just making sure that if you're using that terminology, you don't proactively call somebody queer who hasn't identified themselves in that way. And I think that's just generally speaking, you know, if you think somebody or assume somebody may be LGBTQ+, don't assume, ask them, what are your pronouns? How do you prefer to be addressed? You know, like, how do you identify? Those are okay questions to ask somebody as long as you know them well enough. If you walk up to somebody who may appear to be transgender, who may appear to have a different gender expression versus their biological sex, don't make assumptions and call somebody sir or ma'am. Ask them how they prefer to be addressed. And I think it's just a basic level of human decency.
So I'm just trying to put myself in the minds of people who might be listening to this in a kind of broader audience, right? So maybe people who aren't, who haven't ever thought about this or who are a little bit resistant to this topic. And I'm just going to ask some questions based on what I would think they would want to know. So first of all, this is just so complicated, right? I want to go back to a time when like girls were girls and boys were boys and it was all very simple and nobody talked about it at work because it's fine what you do at home, but at work we don't talk about it. What's at stake if I bring that attitude into the work environment?
I think I have two answers to that. I think the first thing is just by bringing an attitude of maybe let's go back to a historical norm is instantaneously telling people that your own sense of self doesn't matter. How you enter the world, how you view yourself in the world doesn't matter. There are, if we want to go back to a simplistic analogy of, you know, when girls were girls, where there were, I have four sisters. I have two of my sisters that are more, quote, manly than most of the guys I know. Both of them work construction. They've driven, you know, major rigs. Like what defines gender is frankly social norms and social values and not a truth about what the core performative nature of gender is. And I think if we really do look back into history, we look into nature, you see homosexuality, you see gender queerness. There are gay penguin couples who adopt an egg that's been abandoned and raised it together. And there are examples throughout human history. I know many different cultures that have accepted and acknowledged homosexuality, transgenderism, or beyond for millennia, including the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire, many people don't know this, but under early Justinian Code, there was actually an acknowledgement of queer marriages. But we don't talk about these things. You can look at ancient Greek culture and pederasty. Like, these aren't new concepts. Unfortunately, so much of what we look at has played through religious trend that is actually born only from the 1940s and beyond, where new versions of the Bible or new versions of the Quran or the, you know, Talmud and, you know, rabbinical teaching, like all of these things have kind of changed some of the dialogue that we have at a social level. So I think it's overly simplistic to say, let's go back to an age when, because frankly, girls were never just girls and boys were never just boys. And it is a very narrowing mindset to think like that.
Yeah, I was just thinking, we have talked about work being weird now, obviously, the name of our podcast, and everyone always says, well, work has always been weird. It's just that we've applied these structures to it that don't actually work for human beings. And so work's fundamentally always been weird. Then we start talking education. I was just thinking we need like a gender is weird now, because actually our definition, the structures we put around gender have historically been weird, not the actual gender itself. So what's one moment when allyship really made a difference for you at work?
I've seen it show up in so many different ways. So with one of the prior organizations I worked with, I had this amazing opportunity to move to India and to support the global training of about, I don't know, 1,200 different people. And at the time, India still had Penal Code Section 377, which is actually a legacy from the British Empire, which was an anti-buggery law in place. And the law itself didn't scare me. It was more so the fact of like sociocultural acceptance. So when I moved to India, despite having been out for over 20 years at that point in my life, I went back into the closet. And my fiance, now husband, was sat at home. And with a bit of probably Western arrogance, I went into this situation thinking I'll be able to navigate it just fine. Like, obviously, my partner's not there. I don't have anything to worry about it from a personal safety perspective directly. But I didn't realize how much the impact of going back into the closet, when people ask you about so many aspects of your personal life, just out of genuine human curiosity and compassion, the ways in which you edit the stories to cut things out or to spin it. And at the time I mentioned I was engaged, I wore an engagement ring on my hand, which was obviously on my wedding finger or my ring finger. And I would have people ask me about my wife, ask me if I have kids. It took, I guess, the long way of saying it took a toll in a way that I hadn't realized that it would. And Ally showed up for me in the form of a really great friend. So she was there. She saw firsthand the edits and the struggles that I was going through at a human level. And she also was there just from a coverage perspective to make sure, knowing that I'm 10 and a half hour time zone difference away from my partner, that I had a time and space to actually connect. So she would, you know, let me step out of training times to be able to make a phone call or to be able to respond to my partner when he would call. And she also just checked in weekly, daily. How's it going? Do you need any support? Is there anything I could do to be a better friend? It seems so basic and simple, right? Just normal human compassion. But it meant all the difference because it allowed me to continue to turn up and do the job I was hired to do, while at the same time, it allowed me to know that there was somebody who, you know, frankly, gave a crap about me and wanted me to succeed and to feel supported. And it made all the difference. And I am a better human and a better ally myself because of that experience, and recognizing that that's a great way to turn up for others. Just asking them, how are you? What can I do to support you?
Yeah, and I think often people are concerned about saying or doing the wrong thing. And actually what you're describing there is not anything different than what you would do for any friend in a similar situation, or, you know, somebody who doesn't feel comfortable sharing something about their personal life in the workplace. I mean, what else would you tell somebody who's maybe say, I'm so nervous about saying the wrong thing and I'm just going to disengage from the whole situation?
I've done a lot of work with Tiernan Brady, who led the Irish and the Australian Yes or Marriage Equality Vote campaigns. And one of the stories Tiernan loves to tell is about an Irish MP who was on the telly talking about, support for the community and why the community should vote yes. And he continuously botched the acronyms. He kept calling it the BLT community. And there were members of the community that were, of course, upset about this. Like, how can you advocate for us and you don't even know who we are? You can't even properly identify us. And I think the way that Tiernan approached it is the way that is kind of the core of my ethos and what I started off with in terms of where you meet people. It doesn't matter if the person got the acronym correct, right? At the end of the day, this person is putting themselves out there in a very public way to support our rights and our livelihood. And there's a nice way to pull them aside and educate. But for me, getting the nomenclature or the lingo right isn't the most important thing. I would say that's probably towards the bottom of my list of importance. It's showing up, entering with a curious mind, a kind heart, and the willingness to learn and grow. That to me is the core of a really strong ally.
How, if there's a leader or somebody on a board here thinking, right, how the hell are we actually going to make this real, be really show up and not just be tokenistic, where does a business start?
I think in many ways, it's just listening. It's understanding what does your unique community internal to, you know, your environment need. Every company has a unique footprint. If you're domestically based, where are the cities or regions or areas of your country that you're operating in that may have different sociocultural norms and expectations? Where, if you're a multinational, what countries are you operating in? Because there's a ton of different legal norms in many different places where, you know, same-sex sexual relationships are still illegal, and where people can't be public in their relationships, even in private, you can be put in personal jeopardy of arrest. And there are still countries where there is a death penalty in place. So it's really understanding and listening and knowing what do your people need? What is the environment they're operating in? Because you have a privilege in the corporate culture you create, but also within the four walls of your organization, creating a safe space for people who in their day-to-day life, depending on where they may be based, may face existential threat. You create the safety that then builds an anchor of hope and happiness and joy in that person's life. And I've seen that be not only life-changing at the individual level, but then what those folks, when they're engaged in that way by the organization, what they then give back, because they recognize that sense of safety that the organization has given them, and what they give back is tenfold greater.
So practically, if we're really to get into it, I can use macro as an example, you know, of what we're doing in the next couple of weeks. What have you experienced and you thought that was, you know, fantastic, and then seeing that implication, like you've just said, the impact that that's had?
Yeah, I think so. I've had a couple of very pointy conversations, and I mean pointy as in like people have asked me about my own story, my own journey, and what would you do differently? I don't want to say who it was that asked, but you know, another fellow senior leader within the organization asked, you know, based off of my profile that came out, how would you do things differently, noting that we have a very big Middle East presence and noting that there are some legal restrictions in some of those countries? Would you ever feel safe traveling there? Should we create travel guidance that actually helps people from the community, if they ever had to travel to some of these countries, in feeling safe or knowing what is or is not permissible so that they can keep themselves safe? And I think it's things like that. It's very small, or it may seem small, but they're very tangible things that you can do to make the community broadly know you see us, you respect us, you understand that there's something different that we may be navigating, and you're willing to help support us by creating policies or procedures or other avenues of support that really help us to drive an effective future for the organization.
How has your identity shaped the type of leader that you are today?
I would love to say that it has made me more empathetic and compassionate, and I would hope that it has done. But really, my own identity has made me have to take a lot of step back as I navigate a multicultural and multinational organization. And me being queer, knowing that there are countries where I cannot safely live with my partner, has made me approach situations with colleagues that come from diverse backgrounds and diverse countries, right? Very, very differently in a proactive way. I think it's recognizing that everybody has a different story as to how they've come to where they are, and everybody has a different sense of identity and self, and it's largely informed by the places in which we were raised and brought up, the cultural norms and values, religious norms and values, whatever those may be. Some of my closest friends are Muslim, and we've had the interesting conversations around, you know, religious beliefs. And what I found so fascinating is that while they have their ardent religious beliefs, we can still be friends. We can still appreciate and respect each other as colleagues. And we can have, you know, discussion and debate around some of the topics that I think is really interesting to see the different side of. And I think it's important as a leader to know and understand and to really be curious about where those different perspectives may be coming from.
So LGBTQ plus obviously intersects some other aspects of the workforce, right? So race and class and gender. So what does true intersectional inclusion look like at work? And how do we, as, you know, people who are within organizations, get closer to it?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's something I wish I had, you know, a super articulate answer for. I think you rightly say, Alice, that LGBTQ plus identities cut across every other identity. And what happens typically is, using an example of being, you know, a Black queer woman, it's layers of different complexities and challenges that an individual then faces. And using it like in a very literal sense, you have somebody who's Black, but the Black community may not accept them being queer. And you have a queer community that has historically had, at least in the United States, had issues with racial diversity. So being a Black queer woman can be particularly challenging, and you're navigating your own identity and the politics of that identity, in addition to then what you bring into the organization and how an organization can support that. I think for me, you know, it's just basic awareness. It's recognizing that there are people with these multifaceted or intersectional identities and the ways in which they may need different levels of support based off of the different challenges or adversities they're facing. And I appreciate that it's not always the organization's, you know, prerogative to proactively source out and solve all of, you know, different folks' potential challenges, but it's being aware, at least that base level acknowledgement and awareness that somebody may be facing greater adversity because of those layered intersectional identities than somebody who frankly is a cisgendered, heteronormative white man. And if we can really say it bluntly, right? I mean, I'm a cisgender male. I'm a cisgender white male. I recognize the levels of privilege. And I think privilege is a word that has become perverted. I don't like to think of it as privilege, but I do love Peggy McIntyre's original idea and unpacking this is like, it's a knapsack that you have that somebody's given you that has all of these things in it that you didn't realize you needed in life, but that you've had it handed to you just by, you know, who you are as an individual. And frankly, there are folks from different groups that have had, based off of their sociocultural, you know, origins and where they live, a privilege or a step up in things. If we look at privilege in another way, it's really just an advantage. You've had an advantage that somebody else didn't just by pure circumstances of your birth. And I think if we take away from the word privilege, which oftentimes, in, at least in US culture, ties back to socioeconomic privilege, and you really look at it as a base level advantage, no matter what type that somebody's entered the world with, it helps us kind of rationalize what privilege or advantage really means.
Yeah, I think that's a really important distinction because like all of these conversations, they've become a little bit confused by people misunderstanding the definitions and things like that. And certainly here where you've got still quite a strong class system, you know, this idea, as we all know, we've all heard this argument from kind of white, heteronormative, is that the right word, men, who were told they were given privilege, but may have grown up in an environment where there was poverty or something like that. And to them, it doesn't look like privilege at all. You know, to them, it looks like something very different. And so there's obviously been that pushback. So it's interesting to redefine it in the context of some people were just born with more advantages than others. And we need to be aware of what those advantages, what identities those advantages are tied to often, right? Because they are dictated by what perception people have of us in the world and how easily we move through it. So yeah, exactly. I mean, really interesting. What do you think is a common mistake that people make when they're trying to be inclusive of different identities? Is there something that you see all the time that just causes your sort of your eyes to roll and you think, God, I just wish that they hadn't done that?
Yeah, for me, and I guess, you know, keeping this specifically workplace focused, I think when companies false virtue signal, it not only is it something that is overly performative, but the community really adversely reacts to it. So, you know, a company that'll go through and rainbow wash their office. So you put up beautiful pride banners and pride flags and like, you know, there's a public announcement, but then in the background, the lived reality and the day-to-day experience of your LGBTQ plus employees is not one of inclusion. It's not one where there's policies or procedures in place that support or frankly benefits that support. There's a whole host of things that can undermine the positive intent of, you know, going through. And rainbow washing, like many other types of washing, is a fairly more nascent term, I would say, from the last 5 to 7 years that you've really seen come to the fore. And it's largely because of the corporate levels of sponsorship that you see at a pride parade. And the community has reacted to that. And I'll speak specifically to New York. A couple of years ago, there was actually a rally before the Pride Parade reminding people, and it was a very protest type march of people knocking down barricades through the parade route to remind folks, this isn't a corporate event. This is about people. This is about an identity in an, you know, a marginalized community. It's great to have corporate support and corporate buy-in, but it needs to be authentic. So it's that idea of, you know, just slapping a rainbow flag isn't enough. Just saying you're pro-LGBTQ plus isn't enough. It's really showing up with meat and substance behind that.
I was just about to say substance is the word. There is an explanation that you used in our previous interview for the internal comms piece that I just keep finding myself going back to. And I wondered if you would share a bit more light on it, because I think your approach to this is helping other people's almost probably psychological safety around it. But you've said that you've previously dialed up your queerness in corporate environments to create that safe space for other people, showing that they don't need to suppress, not even dial down, but totally suppress. Could you share more detail on that? Because I think that is something that, I mean, honourable, and I'm lost for words on it really, but it's really, really stuck with me in terms of how you're creating that space for others who may feel that they can't show up.
Yeah, I think having worked again in multiple different multinational companies and had the ability to meet folks and mentor folks from around the world, I recognized very, very early on that as a queer, cisgendered white male based in New York, that it comes with a huge amount of privilege or advantage, that I can walk publicly down the street holding my husband's hand, that if I decided one day, you know, like New York Human Rights Commission has a law that if I walked into the office wearing high heels and somebody said something about it, it's actually a violation of New York law and I could file a grievance against the company. So I use that as a context to say I recognize that I have legal rights protections and advantage just based off of where I'm from, that I can be very visible. And I made a conscious decision at one point after speaking to a number of colleagues globally who couldn't do that, and that they acknowledged, like, gosh, it's so great to see somebody who's so out there and so visible, to kind of turn the dial up. So I would wear heels to the office. I wore heels to every Pride event while, you know, dancing around. I was in public posters and videos and realized that my giant rainbow butterfly wings and my tiara, as much as that may not be my normal day-to-day persona, is something important from a visibility perspective to give hope and symbolism to other people. And it's ironic because in my younger self, I used to joke about the Pride Parade and being like, I just could never be one of those people prancing about in, you know, scantily clad and nothing but, you know, rainbow wings and a tiara and high heels. And then there I was doing exactly that. And I realized the performative nature of me being able to be so public and visible creates that safety for others. And especially when they can't be that authentic and out, it creates a person that they know, especially given where I was in the organization in terms of seniority, it gives them a hope and a feeling that, like, if we can do that, then I'm safe to be me too. And I think it's really important. And this is why visibility, especially when I mention, you know, the board or the executive level, representation and visibility do matter. It shows others, especially the more junior folks in an organization, it shows them that the organization is truly committed to being inclusive, because look at all these senior people that are and look just like me, or that act like me, or that identify in the way that I do. And it's a whole different level of safety that you create when people are more visible in that way.
I mean, I'm so impressed you can wear heels. I can't wear heels.
Oh, and I have a minimum.
I gave up a decade ago.
Five inch minimum stiletto too. So it's not just heels.
It's very impressive.
I've just had a stomach dropping moment. Did I use the right terminology then as well? Was that the right thing to say, or should I have said something else? And this is me just being really, really honest, because I get it wrong. We all get it wrong. It's that fear. Did I use the right terminology and language, or should I have said something else?
You were good, Dan. You were good.
Okay. I'm like, oh my God, panic stations. And don't cut that out, because it's, we all have those moments, right? We're not all perfectly polished. And it's just, it's okay to say, oh gosh, did I use the wrong terminology? Then was that the right thing to say?
The way you addressed it, and I think Alice raised the question before about, you know, somebody who's afraid of saying the wrong thing. We all do it. We're all human beings. We're all going to muck up at some point. And I think there's the first bit, which is you had the realization that maybe I did, or even just that feeling of maybe I did. And then the second piece was you asked the question, did I? And then the third bit is if you need to, right? If you had made a misstep, which you didn't, but if you make a misstep, you apologize and you move on. And I think that that last bit is something that, especially when you're talking about the transgender non-binary community, I've done a lot of training around this. If you accidentally misgender somebody, don't throw yourself on the sword and sit there for 20 minutes making it a big awkward thing and apologizing so profusely that you've now made everyone uncomfortable. Acknowledge you made the mistake, apologize, and then do better going forward, right? Like, that's the key of it. So I just wanted to use that as an example of it's okay to get it wrong. And I know you super well, Dan. I know, you know where your heart and your head is. Even if you had gotten Iran, I knew it would never have been from a place of malintent. And I think that's the piece, is being able to show that you care, and that learning process that comes from having the open heart and open mind that we discussed earlier.
Thank you.
I think it raises an interesting question about what is the responsibility of the individual as well. I mean, obviously, a lot of what we're talking about here is how can organizations reduce that tension and create a place that is inviting for all people. But what advice would you give to young LGBTQ plus people coming into the workforce to help themselves? Like, what would you say to them that they can do to help to maybe alleviate some of that potential friction that could exist between their identities and the organizations they're going into?
There's a lot of really great resources now that didn't exist when I entered the workforce, and I won't say how long ago that was. But you know, there's a lot of really great tools. Like the HRC does a ranking of organizations, Stonewall does ranking of organizations. I think doing your homework a bit before you even enter the door or before that first interview. I would have never, when I first started in the workforce, asked questions about inclusion, belonging, what sort of employee resource groups or business resource groups does your company offer. Actually, doing that homework up front helps saves you a lot of pain and energy, because there are sometimes cultural mismatches. And so really making sure that the organization is a place where you can thrive at an individual level is really critical. Once you get in, and you know, when I say that I've done about 25 years on the side of my desk in DEI or inclusion and belonging programming, I did it because I cared about it. And, you know, to Dan's point on, I knew I could be somebody that could make a difference. And I don't mean that arrogantly. I mean that in the sense that I was comfortable enough in my own identity that I didn't mind being visible in a way that, even if it made some of leadership uncomfortable, it gave a safe space to others. But what I learned through my 25 years of doing that type of work is actually by being involved and showing that type of leadership in addition to what you do every day gave me unparalleled career advancement opportunities. And I can give some examples, right? In the prosecutor's office, I raised my hand to do a training for victim advocates, and it was really trying to create sensitivity. There had been a couple of really brutal attacks on lesbian couples in the area where I was working as a prosecutor. And from a sociocultural perspective, some of the victim advocates maybe weren't the most delicate in approaching that. We had this really great session, and actually, because of the leadership I did there and showing people just how to show up with compassion and kindness, especially to the victim of a crime. But through that, the prosecutor saw the work I was doing and said, "You know, I want you to help us build an entire pipeline of different trainings that we can do to kind of just create better awareness on how we can be better on the victim witness side, and then also how we as prosecutors can be more sensitive to some of the needs of different parts of the community that we haven't ever really thought about before." That then led to a promotion. From there, a boss at the prosecutor's office knew that I was interested in kind of expanding and changing some of my remit. So he came to me and said, "Would you consider a role at a bank doing counterterrorism investigations?" And I said, "I'm game for it." All of these things kind of led to the Diversity and Inclusion Council. It reported directly to the CEO and then the chairman for the Americas. That's exactly how I joined corporate real estate. I was working in the legal function at the time, and they said, "Wow, this is really great. We see your thought leadership. We want you to create a workplace culture, physically workplace culture, that helps support all of our staff, no matter what background they come from." So there's great things, because if you really do get involved, if you really do show that you care about these types of issues, even in the complex political climate that we find ourselves in today, leadership at organizations, by and large, are still committed to the principles of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And leadership are still trying to drive that type of corporate culture. So it will net benefit you individually to make you feel more acclimated to the environment and to help shape the environment to be a better one, while at the same time giving you absolute access to people in the senior seats who then see the additional value you bring.
So if you could speak to your 22-year-old self starting out in the workplace, because you are projecting a very confident, very sorted, very sort of with a very balanced and quite sophisticated view on what this all means and what allyship means and how organizations can do it better. But I'm assuming that that wasn't always the case. And so if you could go back and tell your 22-year-old self starting out in the workplace something of value, what would you say?
Yeah, I've thought about this a lot. And for me, I guess there was a period when I first started in the workplace where I felt I had to perform for others, and where a lot of how I showed up at work was more muted. And I think to the point that we discussed earlier, realizing that I could take up a bigger amount of space by being authentically who I am, and that what that would create for others, I would tell the 22-year-old me, don't be shy to wear the high heels into the courtroom and let somebody comment on it and stand firm in who you are. Because at the end of the day, if people jeer or make fun or whatever, honestly, who cares? Because what does their opinion matter? It's really acknowledging that you're creating a space of safety for others. And I think for me personally, that's one of my core drivers, is knowing that I've left an organization better than when I entered, and that I've created a space of safety that other people can fill, even if I'm not there.
Great. So, what gives you hope about the future of work for LGBTQ plus? I can hardly get all the letters all together myself. LGBTQ plus people.
I think for me, what really hearkens this Pride Month is I've seen a big reaction from the community noting we're not going to be relegated to silence. We're not going to go back to a point in history where our rights and livelihoods were jeopardized just by our mere existence. And it's giving me the comfort and confidence to know that the community will continue to push for support and advancement and the basic levels of rights and recognition that any community deserves. More than anything, I think in this exact moment, and a lot of politicians like to use that term, meeting the moment. If we're meeting the moment, we're recognizing that particularly the transgender community and the non-binary community is under attack. I personally have bought a 20-foot trans flag that I wear as a cape when I go out in public, and I've seen in that I live in the Hudson Valley. We've had the largest trans flag walk across the walkway over the Hudson. So the largest trans flag in the world made its way across a pedestrian bridge that crosses the Hudson River. And seeing the community show up in allyship for different demographic groups within the LGBTQ plus banner continues to give me the hope and confidence that we are here for each other. We remember what empathy, compassion, and allyship are all about, and that we're going to continue to show up for each other. And I think that that's going to continue to show up in the workforce and in the workplace.
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, I've actually spoken to a couple of people about this topic who have also said the same thing, that despite what might be happening in the political context, the on the ground within the organizations they work in, they're still seeing the same kind of commitment to DEI that's been there over previous years, which is obviously a really encouraging sign, and hopefully it will continue.
Yeah. And I think no matter whether people are very front-footed or public about the DEI policy, or frankly, what we're seeing is a lot of publicly traded companies start to be more muted in what they say externally. Internally, we can all recognize that diversity, equity, and inclusion actually drive overall bottom line productivity and support, and it drives a better workplace culture and environment. So, no matter how we want to label it and under what banner we want to fly that flag, the basic level of human acceptance, recognition, respect, and tolerance, it's all critical to making sure that the corporate environment thrives. And I can't imagine a world in which we just start to go back to a lack of that kind of empathy.
Great.
Thank you.
Amazing. Thank you so much. This has been a really wonderful conversation, and I'm sure a lot of people will find a lot of value in it. How could people get in touch with you if they wanted to discuss more about this topic?
Yeah, I would love for people to connect. I think LinkedIn is probably the best way across multiple different platforms for people to get in touch with me. My profile is linkedin.com/in/Tony, Tony Maroney, Marroney. Feel free to reach out to me, message me on LinkedIn. I'd love to connect with folks who are working in this space or people who are just generally interested. I love to be a resource for folks who may be questioning or challenging or wondering where they can get more involved in their own organization. So don't be shy to reach out, and I'm happy to be a supporter.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alice. Thank you, Dan. You're both fabulous. And it was such a great privilege to speak to you today. So thank you for the invite. I genuinely appreciate it.
Absolutely. Our pleasure.